It is just and lawful laws authorized by Congress. This powerful statement of the United States policy toward the Indian found expressed in the Northwest Ordinance Act. It represents the white man's attitude toward two separate ideas, the Indian land claims and good faith. That is the whole general attitude about American society toward the native Indian. When speaking about Alaska, Alaska represents a garden of plenty. The Alaskan natives lived in a balanced cycle. By living in a balanced cycle, I mean that they did not know that the Alaskan natives were conservationists. Because of the life, game was plenty, the rivers, great abundance of various of kinds of species of fish and sea mammals, and native harvest according to their needs to survive. The land to the natives is unlimited for hunting purposes, and the sea was unlimited. We might say that the whole attitude of the natives was based on the nature of evidence, insofar as the usage of the four seasonal occupancy, the usage of land, meaning that the land, which does not belong to any form of government, that is the federal or state, just unlimited, vast, plain land in the eyes of the natives. And the usage of our campsites, the usage of our hunting, usage of fishing, and the usage of culture of our ancestors, and the usage of our educational system of teaching in our old ways. When speaking about the native people's origin and their manner of survival, beliefs and attitudes, as well as describing the manner in which they sought their subsistence and prepared it, should be very thankful for our forefathers, not only because they themselves faced an unfair odds and possible living conditions, but because they took the time to teach and educate the younger people with their creative geniuses. They matched their skills and natural resources to their basic needs. The word subsistence has no one meaning today to the native people who live in different geographical locations. Subsistence to the native culture is the pride of identity, self-image that our ancestors, who for generations have passed down the way of life to survive. Our ancestors, not knowing of the westernized global world, were not Americanized to depend on the resources of canned goods. Subsistence for the natives was based on the nature of evidence, depending on the seasonal occupancy, utilized the ingenuity of their own ways. Therefore, the land was the important resource to people, and mileage a person had to cover this land was also important. Because of the passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, ANSCA, certain words or definitions cannot be described by the native language. The word acre cannot be found in any Yupik Eskimo language, nor the concept of measuring land in this manner familiar to the natives. Another word that cannot be found in Yupik Eskimo language is the word square. These are only some of the words that are not found in our ancestral language because of the uniqueness and the living conditions of our ancestors experienced. I'd like to add in here that the word corporate is not also found in the native language, cannot be described. The vast areas traveled by the native groups follow the pattern of migrating animals, that they did this to obtain food. In the past, there were no markers of any kind denoting where the wildlife refuges, where the wildlife refuges were. For instance, down along the coast of the Monarch, there is a place called Clarence Wildlife Refuge. I don't know how it got there, but it's there, and the people can travel along the coast and do not know that they're in the refuge. The people were aware that there is wildlife refuges were established there, now surrounding the Aboriginal rights to hunting. Let me stress that, again, that Congress has developed the rules and regulations creating refuges within Alaska. In doing so, they use their expertise of not knowing where refuges are placed, and they have not visited the area where the refuges were established. They make wildlife refuges so that the birds and many animals have a place to stay, but forget the human beings who are living off the land. Too many times, people who make rules and regulations do not hear voices of the people who have to abide by the rules that they are made. They do not have the slightest concept of or idea of what it takes a native to survive through the hardships in a village. Through the rules and regulations of the lawmakers, not only look at one side of the coin, but also take away the identity, self-pride, image of our ancestors, who for centuries passed down through ages, where again the needs of the natives are being forgotten. The most complex and strong piece of legislature ever put before Congress of the United States of America was Public Law 92-203, which was passed on the 18th of December, 1971. This is the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The American society, through this act, have already fenced our native people into tiny square boxes. They have fenced our cemetery and historical sites into tiny square boxes. And above all, they have fenced our future great-grandchildren into tiny square boxes. I would strongly recommend that the different agencies stop and think for a minute. Maybe it takes the American society centuries to think, to at least consider that it takes a native to learn the real skills of hunting. This demands strength and perseverance. It takes a caring native to pass on to the new generation the creative arts of singing and dancing. It takes a wise native to learn the use of language that has more meaning than words. Maybe it takes a strong white man to appreciate all these things and to prove his good faith toward the whole attitude of the natives, which is based on the nature of evidence. That is to say, in the usage based on the four-seasonal occupancy, the usage of land, meaning that the land does not belong to any form of government, that is federal or state, unlimited vast plain land to the eyes of the natives, and the usage of culture of our ancestors, and the usage of our educational system of teaching in our old ways. There's a quote which is unknown. It says, "Is it not wrong that the history of our ancestors has passed and our generation is faced with the new major challenges of the future that we do today as human beings because we depend on them. I'd like to state one thing here, quoted from Senator Stevens during the address of the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention. Quote, "I really hope you do remember that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is not written in stone. It has been changed repeatedly over the last 12 years at your request," meaning the Native corporations. "Congress has never failed to respond to your requests. It has responded to the consensus among the Alaskans to an understanding developed by the Native communities, the state, and the Interior Department to a general agreement that modifications of ANSCA were necessary to deal with the problems in land settlement." Thank you.
Thank you for those thoughtful remarks, Mr. Moses.
I'm Loretta Pingaig. I'm from the Chalista region. I would like to make the observation that from most of the testimonies I've heard here, the underlying message seems to be that the people who work who are involved in the corporations need more education about the, you know, what corporations are. And the other big problem I see is lack of communication between the corporation members and their shareholders and communication is the most important tool in our lives to get messages across and things like that. If the people and the corporate people who work in the corporations and their shareholders are educated somewhat, they'll have more, you know, understanding of the ways and how to make decisions and all that. But today, I think they're they know they made a mistake. You know, from their mistakes, they learn the what to do next time, and you know. And you mentioned something about corporations giving the people, the shareholders, the opportunity for jobs, and I think that's, you know, true. The people in the villages, there's hardly any economic resources, and so the schools or the city and the corporations are the only places they can work. And I really like that. The opportunities they give to the people, otherwise, you know, they wouldn't have had any jobs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I don't know whether we've heard from everyone who wants to speak. It may be that some members of the faculty want to speak. I don't know. I don't know how the students feel about that. I think they probably would like to hear from them. But we could perhaps leave that till this afternoon or... when is the next class? On the record, right, okay. Well, that sounds reasonable.
However, have a few notes. My name is Mike Gaffney, and I'm with the Alaska Native Studies program here at the university. I guess, Tom, the several observations that I'd like to share with the commission at this point let me make the first point that it seems to me a rather interesting and intriguing facet of the way you conduct these kinds of studies is that it almost to me amounts to sort of an oral history of Native social change in the current modern historical period, and in terms of Alaska Native history, obviously 1971, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is a benchmark. But it seems to me that this era, 1971 to the present, and thinking about social change and the impact on Native communities and the everyday life of Native people, this era includes more than simply the specific implementation of ANCSA by the Native corporate structure. It includes more than the specific Native institution building as a direct result of ANCSA. And that it seems to me that perhaps it would make, at least it makes some sense to me, to take a look at the cumulative impact of events that have happened in this period on Native communities and the everyday social life of these communities. And what I'm attempting to get at is that in this period from 1971 to the present, not only have you had the passage of the Land Claim Settlement Act and the implementation of the Settlement Act through Native corporations and the tremendous imperatives, it seems to me, that the Native corporations and new economic institutions have faced, the issues and conditions that they are constantly facing, and the sense of urgency that corporations, at least from my way of thinking, must feel almost on an everyday basis. The 1991 issues, the kids born after 1971. But I think we also need to recognize and understand that there have occurred, in addition to ANCSA, a number of other historical events from 1971 to the present that have added cumulatively to the social impact on Native communities. The short list I have is, for instance, the extraordinary radical change in the structure and delivery of educational services in this period of time, the development of the rural school districts, the REAAs, the regional educational attendance areas, and suddenly the need in very, very short order to develop Native school boards. And again, I would have to suggest that as the development of corporations requires prior background experience, some basis of organized knowledge, cultural switching, if you will, so too does the development of governance structures, systems of governing and controlling educational services for kids in regions and communities. Also, during this period of time, you had a dramatic change in the delivery of and the availability of secondary education. And what I'm referring to here is the development of secondary education programs in some 200 Native communities. And consequently, the year-long now the adolescent population in villages, as prior to the small high school program, spent a fair portion of time outside the village. Now they're inside the village, and also rather unique nature of small high schools, in terms of curriculum that needs to be multi-graded and teacher training for secondary certification that is more generalized than one would expect for the licensing of teachers in urban comprehensive schools. The quickness with which these small high school programs were put into place by law, by the consent decree, and not only the putting into to place very quickly the programs, but also in many cases the fiscal plans that go along with school programs. And it seems to me that when you begin to add up those sorts of events and changes in everyday life of communities, pile that onto the events and changes brought about by ANCSA, we're beginning to see that maybe we're talking more about a geometric or exponential degree or course in change and impact on Native communities. In addition, in the 70s and on into even the present day, there has been an extraordinary influx of capital improvement projects in Native villages. State oil royalty monies and also as a consequence of some very astute maneuvering by Native legislators has led to many parts of rural Alaska, Native Alaska, money available, resources available for capital improvement, water and sewerage systems, housing, and the observation has been made that perhaps, again, with the sense of urgency, that in many cases these capital improvement projects have not been quite as well planned, as designed, as appropriate as they may have been if there was more of a lead time, more time to think through not only the specific purposes and goals with which these capital improvement projects were set out to accomplish, but also some reflection and thought on, and as always happens to use your term, northern industrial development situations, there are unanticipated consequences. You affect one part of a social group's life, a social system, it's going to lead to impact and changes, consequences for other parts of that system. With the development of using state and federal capital improvement projects as a basic example, what this seems to me has meant is that increasingly on an everyday basis, Native communities are brought more into the technological production orbit of a Western industrial society. And along with this, I think also includes the increase in mass communications and the impact of mass media on rural communities. That certainly opens up a whole new series of windows to other parts of life in the world, in the United States, Alaska, and the world generally. And one of the things, it seems to me, about this whole process of techno-economic development, northern industrial development, is that it comes in packages that are very hard to take apart. They seem to develop a momentum on their own, and it's very hard to be selective. Well, we'll take this part, but not that part. And these packages, of course, when you talk about housing and new water, sewer systems, these packages become gift wrap and become very difficult at first glance to turn down. And then, too, during this period, we've seen the development of the Alyeska pipeline and just general, not just from state, from the public sector, but also from the private sector, a continual development of an industrial system in Alaska that increasingly brings Native people into operating and having to cope with its domain. And so taken together, all of these different events and processes of social change, and add them to the basic structure and functioning of the Native Claims Settlement Act, it seems to me it represents a fairly extraordinarily cumulative impact on every aspect of community and individual life. And in this semester, in our Alaska Native Social Change class, students and I have been looking at these issues of social change. At the beginning of the course, we spent some time reviewing portions of your Mackenzie Valley Pipeline study, which we concluded really, it was an assessment of a possible environmental impact of that particular proposal, but it, as we read through and discussed your analysis of the situation, it seemed to me that you were talking about describing Native social life, putting together a very comprehensive description of a Native economy, that in fact it did exist, and that it had some very unique aspects to it that differentiated it, made it different from the northern industrial development. The social and physical environment of Native communities. And I guess I've tried to list some of those. And then on the other side of the ledger, we seem to be able to observe and identify certain social outcomes. Social change and social costs and problems in many discussions seem to go hand in hand. People talk about Native social change at the same time the conversation or the discussion, the analysis can switch to social problems. But you have this one list of the inputs, the factors that seem to be contributing to changes, cultural, social, psychological changes, which we list as outcomes, unfortunately, in most cases, as social costs of northern industrial development. But it seems to me what we've got to have a problem with is what I call a problem of the black box. That is, we can list the factors here, we can list the outcomes here, but what do we know about what goes on in between? I mean, we have a certain time period, and we see these things happen that we think are causing these outcomes. But what about the social, cultural, and psychological dynamics that go on in people's everyday lives in Native Alaska that may, if we can get some insight into those, into what I call the black box idea, then maybe we'll begin to understand and better be able to hook up how these factors of social change are in fact resulting in some of these social costs or outcomes. One of the one aspect of that this kind of fuzzy notion of the black box seems to be evident is that if anything is going on, it is the development in Native communities of an environment of mixed messages. And I think particularly younger generations, youngsters, are victims of mixed messages, their world, community's world is now pluralized, it's being impacted from a number of different sources by a number of different factors, and there are, as a consequence, sending two individuals, one segment of the community is sending certain messages, another segment of the community may be sending other messages. I think there's a number of Native students here at the university who are here as a result of receiving messages from their community that we need you folks to go out to university, get a university kind of education so that you can come back and work in and help us put together these new institutions that have been essentially mandated. And I suspect that those kinds of messages put a considerable amount of, at least I would feel a great deal of pressure on individuals. And then the university sends out a set of messages from its institutional operation. And I think when you have a developing environment, when you have this extraordinary cumulative social change conditions, that one of the things that's going on and is really affecting individuals as well as particular groups of folks is is this continual sending, many cases very tacitly, of messages, mixed messages that can lead to a fairly confusing existence and trying to sort out one's life and one's aspirations and cultural identity. And perhaps the, as I have termed it, the oral history approach that you folks are taking, and eliciting testimony from communities with in the manner that you do may in fact help us get into the black box and understand it a little bit better. One other quick observation, if I may. In thinking about Native communities' implementation of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, I think it may be worthwhile to recognize that within the Act itself, it seems as if some provisions have almost institutionalized potential conflict situations within the Native community itself. And what I'm referring to is, and I'm not saying conflicts that need necessarily arrive, but they give, they kind of institutionalize the potential for intra-Native community conflict, adversarial, the emergence of adversarial conditions. The notion of village corporations and regional corporations. It seems to me that there's some evidence that each of them, from the beginning or in the implementation history, do can in fact develop what might be called separate realities, operating from separate realities. Consequently, thinking about land use, planning, etc., in different ways, with villages being much more concerned with the traditional use, subsistence use patterns. Regional corporations, on the other hand, of course, being very concerned to keep afloat, to meet the imperatives they feel they have to meet in terms of income, revenue. I think also you have built-in conflict between village shareholders and at-large shareholders. I think there's some evidence, for instance, that one of the critical differences between native corporations and conventional corporations is that in conventional corporations, as a shareholder, a stockholder, you can vote with your feet. You can get out. But with native corporations, you are a shareholder, and as a consequence, village corporations, many of which have had simply have to operate under conditions that are difficult to say the least in terms of management and making a corporation work in conventional corporate terms. Shareholders' dividends are tied to how that village corporation does. Those who did not enroll in village corporations but enrolled in a regional corporation then became at-large shareholders do have received on a regular basis over the early years of the Act in some cases a fair chunk of money which village corporation shareholders did not receive. I think there also is an urban-rural conflict situation that's built in. That those regional corporations that have large urban shareholder populations, that the urban shareholders are going to, in many cases, want to see that particular corporation operate as much as it can like a conventional corporation. Income maximization, dividend allocation. But then also within the regional corporation, then you have rural populations who may be less interested in those income maximizing objectives of a conventional corporation and more interested in the corporation doing particular kinds of things in terms of preservation of the land use management operations, playing more of a advocacy function, political advocacy function for them. Perhaps would be more interested in the regional corporation doing things that may not maximize revenue, corporate income, but may provide or develop some economic occupational structure in rural areas. So it seemed to me, Tom, from almost the very beginning, just looking at the provisions and thinking about the provisions of the Settlement Act, that sort of, in some ways, it almost institutionalized conflict situations. And quite frankly, given all of the sense of urgency and the complexity and the conditions under which the native communities had to put together these new institutions, I think I think in many significant ways, it's been an extraordinary achievement. You know, in the original, in the land claims bill itself, there was, not only was there no provision, but no hint of developing the cadre of people who were going to carry out and operate these corporations. You know, it's like, here it is, folks. Do what you can with it. And given the, from the very beginning, the very complex, problematic nature of it, the legal issues, the political issues, previous speaker indicated that in the history of in American corporate history, not a whole lot of corporations have survived. But given all of these conditions, I think some extraordinary work and achievements have been done.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
Well, we heard earlier from quite a few students and then from Professor Gaffney. I think some students joined us in the last few minutes, and I just want to welcome you and tell you that my name is Tom Berger, and this is the Alaska Native Review Commission, and we're here on the campus to see what Alaska Natives here and other students who may or may not be Alaska Natives think of ANCSA, the way it's worked out, the 1991 issues, shares, taxation, the the question whether children born since 1971 should be entitled to participate in the settlement, all of these questions of native land and government. So if you'd like to come forward and just take a seat and give me your views, I'd sure welcome it. Mr. Sykes is with me. He tapes it all and then it's typed up, so there's a permanent record of what's said, and that'll come back here to the university to be available to you all, not only what you say here today, but what other people in other towns and villages have to say to the commission.
Hello, I'm Teresa Slatz, and I'm from Chivac. I'm pursuing for BS in Land Resource Management, and I aspire to work for my corporation sometime in the future. I have a few questions that I'd like to express to the Review Commission. They're just simple suggestions. My first suggestion is that I think the elders need to understand the Engsha issues, and therefore there should be a media campaign which includes talk shows in their own language. The elders don't really understand because they're so used to living in traditional ways, which they should survive through subsistence alone. My second suggestion that I have for is, like, during the annual meetings, I think that the important meetings should be held in the villages where the issues could be heard.
You mean the annual meetings of the corporations?
Well, any kind of meetings pertaining to ANGSA, mm-hmm. ANGSA issues. And some of the village leaders that attend meetings in Anchorage or elsewhere end up getting drunk and not doing what they're supposed to do. And that's part of the reason why some of the villagers lack the information of the ANGSA issues. And my third suggestion, this is my last one, and if they haven't reached a specific conclusion on what they are going to do before 1991, I think that they should expand it until everything is precisely cleared. And overall, I am proud of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and I would try to do anything to help out. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Slatt. Thank you. Any others who came in just a few minutes ago who would like to speak? We'll be back again this afternoon when I think one or two other classes are going to be coming, so you'll have a chance then as well. But if you'd like to speak now, we will all wait and postpone our lunch until we've heard from you. If we do go for lunch, what time should we come back?
There's a class period from 12 to 1:30, and then so assuming that we don't have any class scheduled for that period, so maybe that would be a good lunch break, 12:40 to 1:40, and then the next class starts at 2:50. I mean 1:50, right? There would be an hour.
Okay. I think I understood that.
In other words, about an hour. Right. To make it short.
Well, it does look as if we are going to go and have something to eat, so we'll adjourn now and come back at 1 1:45. So we'll see you at 1:45, and please feel free to speak then or to add to what you've said this morning. And thank you very much.
Yeah, there you go.
Sure. Good. Made it down.